The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, the on-again, off-again summit with North Korea actually happened last Tuesday. Immediately after, President Trump sounded supremely confident.
But we signed a very, very comprehensive document, and I believe he's going to live up to that document. In fact, I think that he will start that process right away.
But did he and Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un accomplish anything? Time will tell. Senator Lindsey Graham is realistic.
You've got to have an agreement that has no wiggle room. There is no middle ground. So it's time to call the question on North Korea.
Did fear play a role here? Dennis Prager thinks so.
I want America feared more than loved. To keep civilization going, authority figures need to be feared.
And a surprise primary upset of a veteran congressman, a never-Trumper, in South Carolina.
He is a remarkable man, and no doubt we won this race because, the truth be told, we need to support the president.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Let me invite you again to catch my own program, Monday through Friday, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, and 24/7 on podcast and TuneIn Radio. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. Following last fall's overheated rhetorical back and forth between them, the tone from President Trump and North Korea's Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un has been blessedly quiet since early winter. South Korean President Moon's work certainly played a role in cooling things down. So did the Winter Olympics hosted by South Korea, who invited its longstanding foe, North Korea, to participate. Shortly thereafter, we learned that newly appointed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had secretly traveled to North Korea to engage with Leader Kim. A meeting was then arranged between the two leaders and a date set. Skeptics said it would never happen. Many in the elite media seemed to hope the idea would crash and burn. But this historic event did occur on June 12th, as scheduled. Philip Rucker, White House Bureau Chief of the Washington Post, was in Singapore for President Trump's press conference that followed. He joined me shortly thereafter on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Give us a sense of how the day unfolded for Philip Rucker and thus for every reporter.
Well, it was a remarkable day, really extraordinary. It started here in Singapore about 9 a.m. and the president and Kim Jong-un, in a very sort of carefully staged and choreographed moment, shook hands for the first time. That was the snapshot of history. They stood before American and North Korean flags that were arrayed equally behind them on a huge red carpet. They shook hands for 13 seconds. The president, as he often does with other dignitaries, seemed to be warm, patted him on the back, rubbed his arm a little bit, and then led him into a private room. And together they sat there for about an hour, getting to know each other, talking with only their interpreters present. And from there, it went into a number of other sessions. And finally, they had their signing ceremony where they put their names to this communique pledging cooperation. And Kim Jong-un departed Singapore en route back home to Pyongyang. And President Trump held court at his news conference for more than an hour, taking a ton of questions, including one from me. And I don't think he's yet had a chance to absorb some of the criticism out there about the lack of sort of substance towards denuclearization in the communique that was agreed to. And so he just felt really good. He was buoyant almost, joyful at times. And he stayed up at that podium taking questions for a long period of time. You know, we're used to these news conferences where he'll appear with a foreign leader and only take two questions from American reporters and two from foreign reporters. We've not had a full-fledged news conference in quite some time. This was highly unusual. I was sitting in the third row right behind Secretary of State Pompeo and Chief of Staff John Kelly, and they seemed to be sort of fidgeting as the press conference wore on, wondering why the president wasn't wrapping up. At one point, they sort of gestured over to Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, as if to indicate, okay, time to end this. Let's get on let's get on the road here and head back home to Washington. But the president wanted to keep taking questions, and he did for more than an hour.
What's your assessment after that presser broke?
Well, my assessment was just, wow, this is wild. It was just such a day. And one thing, I don't know if you caught this, Hugh, from your vantage point, but the press conference actually began with the playing of a promotional video. It was really a propaganda-style video that Trump had commissioned by an American production company. But it played first in Korean, and then it played in English. And it was a lot of propaganda-style images of North Korea, of Kim Jong-un, of Donald Trump, and really tried to present an imaginary world where North Korea is prosperous and free. And Trump told us at the press conference that he had shared that video. He had it made for Kim Jong-un. He shared it with Kim on an iPad.
Let me play for you the three grabs, Philip Rucker, and then get your reaction.
We talk about the guarantees, and we talk about unwavering commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This is the document that we just signed.
Did you discuss with Chairman Kim methods to verify, either with the United States or international organizations, that very process?
And do you have a timetable? Yes, we did. And we'll be verifying.
You can convey that to us?
Yeah, we'll be verifying. It'll be verified.
How is that going to be achieved, Mr. President?
Well, it's going to be achieved by having a lot of people there. And as we develop a certain trust, we think we have done that. But we signed a very, very comprehensive document. And I believe he's going to live up to that agreement. In fact, when he lands, which is going to be shortly, I think that he will start that process right away.
And then Donald Trump, in a rare moment of complete candor.
I may be wrong. I mean, I may stand before you in 6 months and say, hey, I was wrong. I don't know that I'll ever admit that, but I'll find some kind of an excuse.
So, Philip Rucker, he kind of raised the bar at the press conference above what's in the statement.
What was interesting about the press conference is he seemed to, every few questions reveal something a little new about what they talked about. He even at one point said that they had agreed to things beyond what was written in that agreement and signed to. But he seemed to be so loose about sort of what had been agreed to, what hadn't, what it really meant to completely denuclearize. How is that verifiable? He wasn't so certain. And it left a lot of people wondering how much he really got out of this deal on behalf of the United States and how much wiggle room he left the North Koreans.
To hear my full interview with Philip Rucker, go to townhallreview.com. Following my conversation with Mr. Rucker, a high-priority conversation was with Lindsey Graham, senior senator from South Carolina. Graham's a realistic, unflappable voice on all matters related to defense and foreign affairs. He was a guest on my program. If Kim Jong-un cheats, does that mean military conflict?
I think so. I mean, if it doesn't mean that, we'll never get a deal. So what does it take to get him to give up his nukes? He's got to believe he's better off without them than with them, that he's safer and more prosperous without his nuclear bombs than he is with them. And the only way you can convince him of that is if he keeps them, he's going to lose his regime.
Now, the president came out, he kind of raised the bar. Let me play for you the two cuts where he raised the bar above the statement. Cut number 10.
We talk about the guarantees, and we talk about unwavering commitment to the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This is the document that we just signed.
Did you discuss with Chairman Kim methods to verify, either with the United States or international organizations, that very process?
And do you have a timetable? Yes, we did. And we'll be verifying.
Can you convey that to us?
Yeah, we'll be verifying. It'll be verified.
How is that going to be achieved, Mr. President?
Well, it's going to be achieved by having a lot of people there. And as we develop a certain trust, and we think we have done that, Secretary Pompeo has been really doing a fantastic job, his staff, everybody. As we do that, we're going to have a lot of people there, and we're going to be working with them on a lot of other things. But this is complete denuclearization of North Korea. It will be verified.
Will those people be Americans or international?
Combinations of both.
Agency people.
Combinations of both. And we have talked about it, yes.
So, Senator Graham, how crucial to the success of this summit is that verification legion of inspectors?
I think it's outcome determinative. Number one, you got to inspect. But getting the uranium and plutonium out of North Korea send it to China, I would imagine is where they would send it. But yeah, you got to have people on the ground to go anywhere they want to go, anytime they want to go, and nothing's off limits. I find it kind of odd that Schumer and other Democrats wrote a letter to the president outlining what a good deal would look like. It's completely different than the Iranian deal. The Democrats are suggesting they must give up all their nukes in their ballistic missile program, anytime, anywhere inspections, get all the plutonium and uranium out of North Korea. I embrace the letter they sent to the president, but here's the question for my Democratic colleagues. If they do cheat, if peace and diplomacy fail, I mean diplomatic efforts fail, are you willing to authorize the use of military force as a last option? Because if you're not, we're never going to get a good deal. We'll see what happens.
Senator, it took us 7 years after the 1994, quote, deal, close quote, to find out they were cheating. And here, do you consider cheating one launch, one test, one barring of inspectors?
Yeah, I think when it comes to North Korea, you've got to have an agreement that has no wiggle room. And if they try to do what they've done in the past, you cancel the agreement and you move to option B. Option A is that they're better off giving up their nukes. They get security agreements they've never had. We end the Korean War. They get economic incentives to give up their missile and nuclear program. Column B is if you cheat, if you play us, then the military option will be used to end your program. There is no middle ground. We've run out of time. It's just a matter of time before they get a missile to hit America with a nuclear weapon on top. They will sell anything they build. That's the big threat. So it's time to call the question on North Korea.
Do you think the president is easily played?
I don't think so. I credit him with getting us to this point. The fire and fury rhetoric has changed the equation. If you think he's not tough, look what he did to Canada, and they're our friends. So the president runs hot and cold. One minute he's willing to embrace all kind of trade deals, and when he believes the other side's playing him, he backs out. So to North Korea, if you play Trump, that's the end of you. You've done this twice with other presidents, promised to give up your weapons, and you actually build up your weapons. If you do this to Trump, that's the end of your regime. I really believe that. And if they don't believe that, we're going to have a war.
What do you mean by we're going to have a war? What does that mean?
That means that if President Trump is convinced they're going back to their old way of doing business, making promises they don't deliver on, actually building up their program rather than destroying it, then he will use military force because he's told me to my face, I'm not going to pass this on to the next president. We've run out of places to kick the can. I'm going to end the program one way or the other. I want it to be a win-win agreement, a peaceful end to their nuclear ambitions and their missile program. That's what I want for the world and the United States. But if we can't achieve that, then we'll use military force as a last resort to end their program.
Are you confident in our ability to tell if they're cheating?
That will be a good question. I don't know what their agreement looks like. We don't have one, but it's got to come to Congress. And the one thing that would be a showstopper for me is if we agreed to withdraw our forces from South Korea. That would be too destabilizing. That would be China winning and us losing. I can never agree to that.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
I want America feared more than loved. To keep civilization going, authority figures need to be feared.
Better to use the stick than the carrot? Dennis Prager when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Yes, the same Alliance Defending Freedom that won the Supreme Court case just recently. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Previous treaties and previous diplomatic efforts with the North Koreans have failed, some of them spectacularly. Neither Democratic President Bill Clinton nor Republican George W. Bush was able to broker with North Korea a lasting denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Previous agreements were signed by Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. Will Tuesday's outcome follow the same pattern? Not necessarily, says my colleague Dennis Prager.
Not too long ago, people were worried about America being attacked by nuclear weapons from North Korea, and today they are much less worried about it. There are people who have written on the Internet, I don't mean commenters, I mean people who have legitimate sites. If Barack Obama had attained this agreement, the right would be screaming treason, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think so. Why would we? The thought that they would dismantle their nuclear weapons and denuclearize the peninsula while sanctions continued until that happened? Barack Obama let Iran off the hook vis-a-vis sanctions, paid them bribe money for hostages, sent them billions in cash. What are we talking about here? There's no comparison. So far, it's an amazing accomplishment. So far, I add that. I wouldn't be shocked if it happens. Well, I would be. If it works, it only happened because President Trump was as crazy, quote-unquote, as Kim Jong-un. Bad guys are not used to dealing with crazy good guys. That's what we never have. We have sweet-talking, nice, let's abide by the rules, let's be gentlemen, let us assume the best in others. That's all of the, that's what happens. Not a guy who's going to call you Rocket Man and I'll blow you to hell. That works. That's what bad people understand. I will destroy your country if you start up with us. Woo, he may mean it. Barack Obama didn't say that, let alone mean it. George W. Bush didn't say it, let alone mean it, nor did Bill Clinton. I want America feared more than loved. That's the way it works. I want teachers more feared than loved. I want the police more feared than loved. Authority figures, to keep civilization going, authority figures need to be feared. So I want the United States of America feared. When was America loved? Periodically, for a brief period of time, Americans going through the French streets after liberating France from the Nazis. Then people were crazy about Americans for a year or two. Note how brief gratitude is. Resentment is permanent. Gratitude is temporary.
For a brief time, the spectacle of North Korean diplomacy has allowed our attention to move away from the 2018 midterm elections. The primaries are loudly underway. For Republicans, it was supposed to be a somber time. We've heard so much about this so-called blue wave that could come ashore in November, setting up a Democratic sweep. In South Carolina, one of the most conservative states, Congressional District 1 produced a surprising outcome. A Republican newcomer has defeated three-term Republican congressman and former governor Mark Sanford. Here's my colleague Mike Gallagher with the now GOP nominee Katie Arrington.
I've been following the race and following your career and watching what happened last night. So thanks for your kind words. But let's talk a little bit about how you tapped into that sort of resentment against Republicans who aren't unified, Republicans who joined the mainstream media and the Democrats in trashing President Trump. And of course, it didn't hurt that you got a little boosted about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon as the president tweeted on your behalf from Air Force One.
He is, you know, a remarkable man. And, you know, this race, I no doubt we won this race because, the truth be told, we need to support the president. I mean, that was the message was drain the swamp.
Right.
And the elitists, you know, the swamp, Mark Sanford was a part of that. He just needed to go. The never Trumper. You know, we need people who are going to support our president. Get the bold conservative agenda that he went out on the campaign trail with and won. We need to be able to support that. And that was something that was resounding in the state of South Carolina.
Well, one of the big takeaways all over the country was that, like it or not, the Republican Party is represented by the titular head of the party, which is Donald Trump. It's the president of the United States. It's always been that way, whoever the prevailing party is. And yet there's this strange dynamic now where people, you know, clash, you know, they clasp their hands and they say, oh, should we criticize the president? Should we not? You never hear that debate among Democrats. Democrats
No.
don't talk about holding their tongue or deciding to criticize their own president from their own party. This seems to be uniquely, I think it's a personality thing where they just don't like the man, they don't like him personally, and they think they've got to trash him. And in doing so, they're stopping a Republican conservative agenda from getting accomplished.
Absolutely. You know, I there's a famous quote, you know, you only put down what you fear. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the liberals, the Democrats, they fear
the conservative agenda. So they don't have anything to say but try and put us down. And the bottom line is it's resounding. This message about President Donald Trump is resounding across this nation. Our economy hasn't been this good in decades. 17-year low, our lowest unemployment. Look what he did in North Korea. It's mind-blowing how you cannot be supportive of a president who, you know, he promises made and promises kept. That's been the whole deal. The DC Democrats have already started to attack me, which was kind of, you know, I was like, wow, they didn't even know who I was a week ago. And now all of a sudden I'm the prime focus of their fodder. Nancy Pelosi and the guy I'm running against, it's literally been their job for, you know, the last 24 hours, it seems, to be bashing me.
Right. And for the record, the Democrat, I think his name is Cunningham. I mean, I've got, you know, plenty of connections in South Carolina. I mean, you're going to be the next congresswoman from the first congressional district in South Carolina. There's just no question about it, because you have the ear of the voters. And this is so important to me. To me, it's about politicians who are able to connect with the voters. And there's a disconnect, frankly, when Congressman Sanford went down this never Trump path and was trashing him and criticizing him and blaming him for the discourse and all of this. That's not what the voters of South Carolina expect.
I say the blue wave ain't hitting the shores of South Carolina, but they sure are going to try. I do need help. So I ask everybody to please go to votekatiearrington.com. This is going to be, you know, it's David and Goliath down here, and I need help from your listeners and Republicans around the country to help any way they can. Donations, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. Just keep the word going.
There really is a powerful takeaway here, isn't there, that despite a conservative track record, and let's face it, Mark Sanford, I know he was, you know, you were the loyal opposition and you guys went at it pretty hard, but it's I think it's accurate to say he had a very conservative track record but it's not enough to be a conservative and then try to oppose or distance yourself from the president of the United States who is getting so much accomplished. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up, California's anti-First Amendment Assembly Bill 2943. Is it unstoppable?
So you have a lot of individuals in California that have actually changed their lifestyle from homosexual to heterosexual, and now they're sort of in a quandary.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The California State Legislature has been operating under a supermajority of Democrats in both houses. What was my home state for 28 years has effectively become a single-party state, even as I moved to Virginia, which is mildly competitive. And the results are now showing up big time in the old Golden State. Consider this. For several months, Assembly Bill 2943, authored by the legislature's LGBT caucus, part of the hard-left California delegation, has been moving through the body relatively unopposed. On its face, this bill prohibits, quote, helping anyone with unwanted same-sex desires or gender confusion, close quote. Last week, the bill made its way to the state's Senate Judiciary Committee, despite a chamber filled with 350 opposing citizens. AB 2943 now appears to be on its way to ratification by the state Senate and the final step of being sent to Governor Jerry Brown's desk. Confusion regarding the bill's full intent is rife. Hoping for clarification, Dennis Prager turned to State Senator John Morlock, a Republican on the Judiciary Committee who voted against the bill.
There is a bill. What is it, 2943? Is that the number?
Assembly Bill 2943.
Right. Why don't you explain to my listeners what this is about? Because, folks, I don't normally cover any state's bills in their capitals, but this one has national repercussions.
So we have an LGBTQ caucus who have put this bill together, and it declares that sexual orientation change efforts, also known as conversion therapy, or reparative therapy is a fraudulent business practice under the Consumer Legal Remedies Act. So if you happen to be someone who is part of the Q component of the LGBTQ, which also refers to questioning, and you go to a counselor, and that counselor, say, is Jewish or Christian and wants to give you a religious perspective, that would then be deemed fraudulent, and that therapist could jeopardize his license with the state. So that's what this bill is trying to do. So you have a lot of individuals in California that have actually changed their lifestyle from homosexual to heterosexual, and now they're in a quandary saying, wait a second, it wasn't really the messenger, the therapist, that changed me. It was a relationship with God that changed me. And so they're reacting, and so is the faith-based community.
So I want to put it in my words. Tell me if it's accurate, Senator, so that it's good for my listeners and good for me to get it clear. The bill would make it a false business practice. You know, so for example, I mean, let's take one that has nothing to do with anything sexual. Give me an example of a false business practice that would be outlawed in any given state.
Oh, that's a great question. Let me try and do a hypothetical. What if we said scientifically that acupuncture isn't really a cure? So now why don't we just go ahead and every acupuncturist in the nation or in the state, excuse me, would now be considered practicing a fraudulent business and would have their license renewed or be subject to penalties or civil action.
Right. By the way, out of curiosity, in light of that, why is hand reading, palm reading, allowed to be a business in California? No, nobody really believes rationally that that's accurate. Why isn't that banned under false business practices?
Oh, great. Give us some more bills to do.
No, I'm very serious. Well, they answer, if they're so adamant about false business practices being banned by law, why can I get my fortune read?
Exactly. Or why don't you just let the marketplace decide whether or not?
Yes, exactly. So now, in this case, it's if somebody wants to go to a therapist and a gay person and says, you know what, I would rather be heterosexual or at least practice heterosexually. Maybe a therapist can enable me to do that. That would now be banned. Is that correct?
With one little modification, they're now changing the bill a little bit to say that you cannot guarantee a result.
So you can actually do it, but you can't guarantee a result? Well, then isn't that a victory for us? I mean, if I hear it correctly, one will be allowed to seek such therapy so long as there's no guarantee offered.
And that may be correct. Now, this is going to be heard at the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I vice chair. It'll be one of 36 bills. It'll be somewhere near the end of the hearing, but they'll have to make that argument because this would be a new amendment, and I don't even know if it has been adopted yet.
So there will be a vote on the amendment?
Correct.
There'll
be a vote on the bill as amended.
Right. Oh, okay, good. So were you in any way responsible for this amendment?
No, sir.
But, well, whoever was, I think, unless I'm reading it wrong, deserves a vote of thanks from those of us who want liberty.
Well, let's hope that the author accepts the amendment, and we'll see what else is amended as we deal with this bill.
To hear this Dennis Prager, John Moorlach interview in its entirety, go to townhallreview.com. Sign up for the podcast, and you will also receive a segment of great radio nearly every day. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
60% of all college degrees going to females. Now, why is that a problem?
There's trouble ahead for America's higher education when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Many stories regarding the plight of women in business have been in the media's front pages recently, indeed going back decades. Much improvement has resulted from shining this light, but we are clearly not yet there. that is shown by the Me Too movement. It appears, however, that women as college graduates are doing very well, to the point that they now outnumber men 60 to 40% in graduations. According to recent studies, this fact is not good for higher education, nor does it lessen other problems like intergenerational poverty. To explain, here's my Salem colleague, Michael Medved.
There are a series of new reports that have come out that suggest that there is a great problem facing our colleges and universities. Well, of course, there's more than one great problem, but this is one that is particularly conspicuous and very, very difficult to explain and to understand and maybe to deal with. The problem is this. Women are killing men and increasingly driving men away from actually getting college degrees. We're just a little click below 60% of all college degrees going to females. Now, why is that a problem? But because women very regularly interrupt careers for childbearing, women are much less likely to earn well, and that means that they repay the debt, if at all, more slowly. Is it legitimate to be concerned about men being so underrepresented at our nation's four-year colleges and universities? Seems to me that it is. And again, I would do the same kind of exercise that I suggest people do with partisan politics. Imagine the situation were reversed. If we were back to a situation where 60% of all the young people in college and university were men, can you imagine the rage and the attention and the activism? I didn't realize that before World War II, the number of men and women in college was actually fairly balanced. Do you know why? Because women were by and large the people who had teaching jobs. And teaching jobs were among the few jobs back in the 1930s where you absolutely needed a college degree. And they used to have state teachers' colleges, specific teaching programs that were overwhelmingly women. I remember when I was growing up, and I imagine many of you do, the overwhelming percentage of the teachers that you encountered, certainly in elementary school and in middle school, were female. Actually, the greatest percentage of teachers in high school as well. Is that one of the reasons that, and why did that change, by the way, during World War II? It changed during World War II because all of a sudden women were taking on different jobs, competing more directly with men. And then when men came home from the war, and it was overwhelmingly men who served in the war, the 16 million people who served in World War II, they had the benefit of the GI Bill. And the people who were encouraged were disproportionately male. In any event, the numbers are these, is that as recently as 1984, 45% of bachelor's degrees in business were earned by women. And then that was up. In 2001, it was up to 50%. And back in 1970, bachelor degrees in business, 9% women. A gigantic change. In other words, it is now 50% or 2001, 50%. Now it's probably more because generally the numbers of women in colleges and universities is much higher. Part of what has happened, of course, is that women have had jobs open up to them in a range of subjects. But why would it be that men would be so much less likely to go to four-year colleges and universities, so much less likely to take on college debt? Part of what is happening here is there are now activists who are saying that paying off, forgetting all of these literally trillions of dollars in college debts that people have incurred really is a female issue, because here's a number. Two-thirds of the outstanding student debt in America is female students. Two-thirds. The idea here about why it is that men have come to be so underrepresented in colleges and universities. And it has to do with some of the fundamental differences between males and females. But it also has to do, it seems to me, with some of the emphasis on inequality and the desire to give encouragement and support to women, even though for 18 years, women have been the overwhelming majority of people actually getting undergraduate degrees. The much bigger gender issue behind the scenes at university and colleges is how to draw more men. The Atlantic piece argues that the anti-school, anti-education sentiment in boys has its roots in kindergarten, when they're slower to learn to read than girls. So said Jim Shelley, who's the manager of the Men's Resource Center at Lakeland Community College in Ohio. Girls at the primary and secondary level worldwide far outperform boys in reading, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. That's the top 40 nations in the world economically. That disparity continues until by eighth or ninth grade, boys have lost interest. It's why boys are so much more likely to drop out of high school, which it is still unbelievable. And this is one area where, honestly, I do wish that Republicans and President Trump included would pay more attention to it. The one change educationally that more than any other could benefit America and help deal with our longstanding problems of intergenerational poverty would be not sending more people to college necessarily, but making sure that every American graduates from high school. Do you know that one out of five Americans ends up without a GED, without a high school diploma? And is it possible to have a wonderful life without a high school diploma? Sure. Is it difficult to have a wonderful life without a high school diploma? It's very difficult.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
When people were talking about that great, irresistible blue wave, forget about it.
Michael Medved with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Since late 2017, and especially the beginning of 2018, we have been told a, quote, blue wave is rolling across the U.S. This is largely rooted in two things. The Democrats did win a couple of important races early in the year, and Donald Trump is exceedingly disliked by the elite political class. Some observers, however, are now saying, not so fast. As primary results in large states like Texas and California have come in, the wave seems to be breaking early, if it ever existed at all. Salem host Michael Medved thinks that blue cities like his own Seattle are showing voters that Democrat domination may be wearing out its welcome.
Do you remember the head tax where the Seattle City Council voted on punishing big companies for every new job they added? They just reversed themselves. Here's the way the Seattle Times covered this story. In a stunning reversal without parallel in Seattle's recent political history, the city council voted 7-2 to repeal a controversial head tax on large employers. Mayor Jenny Durkan is expected to make the repeal final by signing it into law. The vote at a special meeting of the council called by Council President Bruce Harrell came less than a month after the council approved the tax of $275 per employee per year to help fund services for homeless people. It also came as leaders of a referendum campaign to repeal the tax had been preparing to submit their signatures. For the city's leaders, the move amounts to an embarrassing about face. Speaking about embarrassing, the main cheerleader for this head tax, the jobs tax, Shama Sawant, she was one of the no votes against repealing it. She said this about the current state of the conflict.
It is magical thinking to believe that somehow you will be able to win attacks like this without making enemies out of Jeff Bezos. No, Jeff Bezos is our enemy. He is our enemy. And we have to fight big business. The question is, will we have elected representatives who will fight with us or not?
To fight big business as our enemy? Really? She is an open socialist, by the way. She suggested that the workers take over Boeing. Of course, you'd want to fly on planes that were designed by workers, cooperatives, and collectives. And the homeless people, she said, could help with the Boeing manufacturing. This is insanity. And see, with the Democrats nationwide moving further and further to the loony left, just as this Seattle situation indicates, and there are primaries around the country, big primaries in places like Nevada and Maine. But it truly does feel that when people were talking about that great, irresistible blue wave, forget about it.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site, subscribe to our Apple podcast or via Stitcher or SoundCloud or Google Play. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Poesian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Generalissimo Dwayne Patterson. Thank you once again to our sponsors, Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.